This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Kenan Thompson, is nominated for 2 Emmys for his comedy performances on Saturday Night Live and for his starring role in his new NBC sitcom, Kenan. On Kenan, he plays the host of a local morning TV show in Atlanta. The show is all about advice, recipes, and cheerful talk, but he's still grieving the loss of his wife and is now a single father, raising his 2 young daughters, and finding it hard to devote enough time to his family while also hosting the show. It's been renewed for a 2nd season, and you can watch the 1st season free, streaming on NBC Peacock. Kenan Thompson won an Emmy in 2017 for co-writing the SNL song parody, Come Back, Barack. Thompson has been with SNL for 18 years, making him the performer with the longest tenure in the history of the show. Among the recurring sketches he's best known for are the game shows Black Jeopardy and What's Up With That. Some of the characters he's played over the years include Steve Harvey, Al Sharpton, O.J. Simpson, Charles Barkley, and Bill Cosby. Thompson played Fat Albert, one of the characters Cosby created, in the live-action adaptation of the Fat Albert animated series. Cosby voiced the character himself in the animated series. Thompson has had a TV career since he was a child. Kenan Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air. It is great to have you on our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a clip from an episode of Black Jeopardy because that's always so funny. And this is a very special episode of Black Jeopardy that I want to play because it features Chadwick Boseman as the guest contestant.
Mm-hmm.
And for any listeners not familiar with this recurring sketch, could you just explain the premise of Black Jeopardy?
I mean, it's basically in the title, you know. It's the black version, like if Jeopardy was hosted and produced by a mostly black, you know, situation, basically. And it's just to lean into that, you know, different jokes and stuff like that. And what those joke premises are about, basically, would be in the black section of things instead of just the Jeopardy section. So there you have it.
Okay, so here's an episode of Black Jeopardy with, of course, Kenan Thompson hosting, and the contestants are Chris Redd, Leslie Jones, and Chadwick Boseman, but in the role that he plays in Black Panther, T'Challa.
All right, Rashad, it's your pick.
All right, let's go with all hell nah for 400.
All right, the answer, the airline says they want to charge $25 to check your bag. Shanice.
What is all hell no? Looks like I'm gonna fly to Jamaica with a 50-pound suitcase in my lap.
Yeah, you're damn right. You're damn right. That's right. And I dare the stewardess to say something. That's right. Let's keep going.
Let's stay with grown ass for 600.
All right. You send your smart ass child here because she thinks she grown. T'Challa.
What is to one of our free universities where she can apply her intelligence and perhaps one day become a great scientist?
Okay, well, the answer we was looking for was out my damn house. But you know what? I'm gonna give it to you, T'Challa. Y'all must not have no mean streets in Wakanda. All right, the board is yours.
Very well. Let's go to Ahelna for 800.
Okay. The policeman says there's been some robberies in your neighborhood and asks if you have any information.
What is... Not only do I tell this man what I know, but I also assist him in tracking down the offender. After all, our ministers of law enforcement are only here to protect us. Is this correct?
I mean, it should be. But I'm thinking you haven't spent much time in America. Let's just hear about today's prizes. Johnny?
So that was an episode of Black Jeopardy hosted by my guest, Kenan Thompson. That is so much
goodness.
Fun. Yeah, and then, of course, listening back to Chadwick Boseman. That must bring back memories for you.
Absolutely. I mean, that was such an electric week in general, you know. Like, the king, Chadwick, was just blessing us with his grace, number one, because Black Panther was the biggest thing going at the time. And, you know, he contributed and gave all of his efforts and energy to our show like he did anything else while he was promoting, you know, a movie of that caliber. It was just unbelievable to witness, let alone being able to do, like, one of my, you know, beloved sketches, you know, with him in very close proximity and stuff. It was just, it was great. I was close proximity with him that whole episode, like, We did a monologue together where I just, you know, thought I had a good idea to play Panthro from the Thundercats back in the day. So we had built a full Panthro costume. It was the most ridiculous thing in the world, but I had fun, and, you know, he was committed to that too. So the thing about Black Jeopardy that week where we were trying to figure out exactly how to make his, you know, elevate from Tom Hanks, who had just, you know, destroyed it the last time. So it was an uphill battle, but we got there, and he stayed, you know, in it with us. He never, like, got mad or frustrated or, you know, just, like, going back and forth idea-wise in the wrong direction or anything like that. He just trusted us to kind of find it, and we did. And, you know, all the credit to him, you know, he performed the hell out of it.
He knew he was sick at the time, that he had cancer. Did you know that?
Absolutely not.
Not. And so what was your reaction when you later found out that you were working with him when he was actually very sick?
It just floored me. Like, the whole thing, you know, it was just a crazy few months, you know, with, like, him and Kobe. And, like, man, it was, like, a lot of things just coming out of, you know, left field. But the fact that he was working so hard and he was so focused, because in between, you know, rehearsal takes and stuff like that, he was, like, practicing karate moves, you know what I'm saying? So he was always, like, looking like he had other things to do and stuff like that. Like, as far as living is concerned, you know, I never saw him coughing or anything like that, you know? So him being, you know, of ill health was the furthest thing from my mind. If anything, it looked like he just needed maybe a vacation at some point, but a super baller one because he was on top of the world.
Yeah. So how did you come up with the sketch for Black Jeopardy? Was that your idea?
No, it was Brian Tucker's idea, and him and Michael Che collaborated on it. And just, you know, from the very beginning, you know, it was just very straightforward of what it was going to be. And when he originally pitched it to me, I was like, you know, I hope they let us do it because, you know, Will Ferrell kind of territory is pretty sacred. So I just wanted to make sure if we were going to step anywhere near that kind of, you know, echoing of his brilliance, it had to be brilliant in its own. And it definitely was. It was just, you know, an opportunity for us to do a bunch of, you know, old school black jokes in a very smart way. So it was, you know, just very refreshing to be able to laugh at kind of older school humor, you know.
So let's go to 2017. You won an Emmy that year for Outstanding Original Music and Lyrics.
Yes.
For the song Come Back Barack, which was, why don't you describe what the video is like? This is like a song parody.
Yeah, it was, you know, reminiscent of the old school 90s kind of R&B era with, you know, the Jodeci's and, you know, Silks and All for Ones of the World and 112 and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, slow jams, you know, big silky suits and canes and hats and sunglasses and slow motion walks and fans and, you know, deep voices trying to entice the other side of the spectrum to maybe have a wonderful, wonderful evening in the bedroom somewhere or something. But we happened to be singing to Barack Obama to come back to the White House. So.
Right, and so we're going to hear an excerpt of this, and we're going to hear Chance the Rapper singing lead, Chris Redd is one of the singers, and we're going to hear you doing, like, the monologue in the middle of the song. Who did you think about doing a monologue in the song?
It was like, you know, kind of, I think Boyz II Men used to do it, so they had a very deep voice, you know, a guy, I think his name is Mike, and he would always take a moment and be like, girl, you know what I'm saying? Let's take a moment and, like, just slow it down. Slow it down. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. So this is Come Back Barack from Saturday Night Live.
Ooh, come back Barack.
Come on, man. We out in the rain.
Don't leave us here alone.
It's definitely too cold to be rained
on. At least we love the phone.
I mean, I know you're busy with that library and everything.
White House ain't a home.
Well, Trump don't even got a dog, man.
Just come back Barack.
It's been a long time, Barack. Almost as long as since a guy talked over a record like this. Why would you leave us? Oh, because you had to. Because of the Constitution. But you can come back, right? Oh, you can. Because that would undermine the very institutions that we barely holding on to as it is. I see. I guess we stuck with this dude for a while then. Maybe you can come back and make a speech. How much would that cost? For real? Oh, no, we definitely can't afford that. So I'm just getting rained on for nothing. That's interesting. Well, you enjoy your retirement, homie.
Come back, Barack.
Get Shane.
We need you all so bad.
Super bad.
2020's looking sad.
Maybe Michelle could run.
Like really sad, like super sad. What the hell we gonna do sad?
Let's not put Michelle through that.
Let's not put Michelle through that. Hilarious.
What was the music you grew up with?
I grew up with my parents playing a lot of Motown and, you know, soul music and stuff. Gospel, of course, and, you know, Southern hip hop, basically. So a whole lot of Outkast.
Yeah, and you grew up in Atlanta, where Outkast is from.
Exactly. They went to my high school. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We're always very proud of that at our school.
Do you have any nightmare moments from Saturday Night Live that you wish were not preserved?
In history? Yeah. I mean, I had my nightmares early, so they were things that never made it into the show, I guess, because they were so green, you know? But I definitely had like a full fumble moment, drop the ball moment on a sketch, and just was way too green to know how to improv out of it and just let it die and be an awkward situation, you know? But the sketch got cut anyway, so it just lives in the vault wherever it is. But I have the scar of the memory for sure.
Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, it was a sketch called Randy the Bellhop that a friend of mine wrote. And it was, you know, probably my first season. And there was a line that I had that I just fumbled. And I was showing like a couple into their room, and of course it was like a ragtag hotel, so like all the jokes were about everything kind of not working or being kind of fugazi or whatever. And I just fumbled this line super hard, and it was awkward and silent in the studio and so quiet you could hear this one lady say, "Aw." And I was like, well, this is not great. And, you know, I guess someone else in the scene just picked up the next line and moved it forward and we finished it out or whatever. But I was like, I dropped the ball on that for real and tanked the sketch pretty much because everything I said after that that I thought was going to get a laugh was just a mediocre kind of chuckle and just the whole energy got sucked out of it. So it was my first fall on my face kind of moment, but it got cut, you know what I mean? So it's kind of just an in-house kind of a secret or whatever, but yeah, I thoroughly remember. It sucks.
It got cut before the show was broadcast?
Yeah, it got cut out of the live rundown, basically.
I see. So you're still in front of an audience.
Yeah. I mean, dress rehearsal's in front of an audience. So it's two audiences, I guess. And then
they're separate audiences,
in between,
right?
Yeah, in between shows, you know, we get the rundown of what's going in the show.
Well, as a viewer, I kind of enjoy it when there's a little bit of a fumble or when somebody breaks and start laughing when they're not supposed to, because it makes you realize that it's live. And it also seems like, oh, they're really enjoying doing this, and that makes me enjoy it more.
Exactly.
One of the times when John Mulaney hosted the show, and he loves Broadway musicals, so there was a sketch, I think it was called like Diner Lobster.
Yeah.
And so it's set in a diner and Pete Davidson makes the mistake of ordering lobster. And he's told like, no, you never order lobster in a diner. And he says, well, I want lobster. And it's like, no, lobster's never good in a diner. And then it breaks into like a parody of Les Mis and you're the lobster who's going to be eaten. So you're singing about that and you're in this like big lobster tank with like lobster claws, like gloves that look like lobster claws, and everybody's laughing, and you're just like singing.
It was the one of the most like just brilliant things. Like we were finally able to like bring to life because we'd done it at the table years before when John was a writer there, and it tanked because it was just way too random. So for some reason, they brought it back. And it just made all the sense in the world. And it was like, oh, well, duh, we're definitely doing this. And I'm like, that's funny because the first time we did it, you know, it was just swept under the rug and didn't make it past the table. And then at dress rehearsal, so I'm like Jean Valjean. Is that who I am? Yeah. There's, you know, I'm in that giant lobster tank. And, of course, it's on wheels, so they have to push it through a door. But, you know, of course, they, you know, they didn't cut the door frame like very much bigger than the tank. So when a thing like that is on wheels, like when it rolls forward and rolls backwards, it changes direction until the wheels can like turn into the forward direction or whatever. So that little shift to the left or the right can like get me stuck when I'm trying to like get through the door if they don't set the wheels beforehand. So of course, at dress rehearsal, the wheels weren't set in the direction they needed for me to just go out straight. So it shifted a little bit while it was trying to get the wheels turned straight, and I was hitting the side of the wall. The crew guys were like hitting the side of the door with this giant tank while the music is playing, and I have like six more beats before I have to start singing. So all you can see is like a tank trying to get through the door, and there's fog and like these weird claws and like an antenna head. You can't even see it's me. And they barely get me out right before I have to sing. And my first line is like, who am I? And me and 80 were talking about that in between shows and just dying laughing. Like, it was so hilarious. Like, we would love to know the answer to that question. Like, what is happening here? Like, who am I? It was just so perfect.
Why don't we hear that? So here's Kenan Thompson doing a parody version of Who Am I from Les Mis.
Yes.
In the role of a lobster.
Who am I? And why am I condemned to boil alive when all that I have done is live my life?
And why would someone on a whim choose from all to order him? Who's this guy?
I thought that there was an unspoken rule that lobster in a diner's never cool. A diner menu's way too long and half the things are fake or wrong.
Must he die? How can you ever face his lobster friends? How can you ever face yourself again, monster?
Lived here 40 years, I know, an age that lobsters never grow. And in that time, there's been no one to order any crustaceans. Who am I?
Lobster number one.
That was my guest, Kenan Thompson, in a sketch from Saturday Night Live. So what was the Saturday Night Live cast that you grew up watching?
The main one I honed in on for myself, like I remember like watching over my dad's shoulder when I wasn't supposed to be, when he was watching like Eddie Murphy do Hot Tub and stuff. But my era was the Sandler Farley years and Chris Rock years.
Were there sketches that you tried to memorize?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Nat X.
That was like his first thing. That was like Chris Rock's first character, I think.
That was like his like almost one and only, damn near. And the van down by the river, we used to do a lot of that kind of just Farley gesturing in general that he would do in a lot of sketches. And yeah, that whole era, basically. Tommy Boy was like my favorite movie for forever growing up. And yeah, I was a big Farley fan.
You were 25 years old when you started on Saturday Night Live. And I know you were told by, I don't know if it was Lorne Michaels or other people who were doing casting, you were told that you were too young.
For a long time, yeah.
When you were told you were too young, how come you didn't take that as a hard no? Like, because sometimes people try to be polite and say, oh, you're very funny. It's just that you're too young. So leave us alone. You know, like that can be the implicit message. Like, go away.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess in that sentence, you know, allows for time, you know. It just was like, all right, I'm too young right now. So maybe at one point I won't be too young. And if that's the only argument, then, you know, I can definitely wait out the time to where they think I look older and maybe I'll be funnier or more experienced or whatever. So it didn't seem like a closed door or a go away necessarily. It just seemed like it's the second time definitely felt like a little more like maybe I should leave this alone, but I don't know. When I got the call that they wanted to let me try, I was like, well, absolutely. I'll try again for sure. The first two times was like me knocking on the door. The third time was them calling, so it was different.
Oh, yeah, that must have been a great phone call.
Absolutely. Terrifying, but still great.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kenan Thompson. He's nominated for 2 Emmys for his comedy performances on SNL and for his starring role in his new sitcom, Kenan. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is now in session. Everything you want to know about investing from expert guest professors. New classes every Wednesday till Labor Day in the Planet Money podcast feed.
Let's get back to my interview with Kenan Thompson. He's been a performer on Saturday Night Live since 2003. This year, he got his own NBC sitcom called Kenan. He's nominated for 2 Emmys, one for SNL, the other for his starring role on Kenan. He won an Emmy in 2017 for co-writing the SNL song parody, Come Back, Barack. He's been on TV in one kind of role or another since he was a child. So now you're starring in a sitcom called Kenan, like we were saying before, and you play the host of a local morning TV show called Wake Up with Kenan, and it's a show with advice and cooking. It's all very kind of light humor. Your wife has recently died, so now you're the single father of 2 young girls who you're doing your best to raise with the help of your late wife's father, played by Don Johnson, and your brother, played by Chris Redd, who's also on SNL. And it's really hard for you to talk about your wife, like the grief is still so raw for you. So I want to play a short scene from the first episode. You're live on TV on your show, Wake Up with Kenan. And so you're hosting the show, and your co-host, who's kind of proud of being shallow, is there. And your guest is a doula who's giving advice to women about childbirth.
You know, the number one thing I tell new moms is to have a birth plan. But when baby comes, throw it out the window.
Well, I hope you mean the plan and not the baby. No, but seriously, that did happen with my wife, Cora, and I.
And we can talk more about that, because I'm sure the audience would love a personal story, Kenan.
Yeah, no, of course. So we had a birthing plan for both of our babies, but when that pain hit, it went straight to hell. I'm telling you, my wife was probably the first woman in history to get an epidural at 0 centimeters. And I would never let her live it down. She would stub her toe, and I'd be like, oh, we need an epidural, stat! Or we go to a restaurant and I'd say, she'll have the kale salad, the risotto, and the epidural.
I love that. But all jokes aside, moms should wait as long as possible for drugs if they can stand the pain.
So you're calling my wife soft now?
What? No, it's just better for the baby.
Oh, so now she wasn't looking out for our babies. I'm sorry, but my wife was an amazing woman, okay? And she gave birth to 2 beautiful girls, all right? Ellen, thank you. And it's not like she took the easy way out and got a C-section or nothing like that.
Oh, to be clear, C-sections aren't the easy way out. It's a very serious surgery.
Very serious?
No, right. No, I was joking. No, Ellen, I was joking. My wife used to even joke. She used to say stay-at-home moms could just pop them things out at any old time, but she was so busy. She needed that C-sizzy. Am I right? Am I?
Sorry. Are you criticizing stay-at-home moms now?
Oh, God, I hope not. No, okay, in conclusion, I just want to say stay-at-home moms work harder than working moms. Nope, they both work equally as hard. All moms are heroes. So it goes like this. It goes to troops, and then stay-at-home moms and working moms are tied for second, and then 9/11 first responders. Didn't mean to mention 9/11.
What is happening to you?
Oh, come on now, y'all. Y'all acting like I called Beyonce fat.
That's it.
Yes, spiraling out of control. I love it.
You know, I think for anybody who is in a relationship and loves their partner or spouse, that thinking about the possible death is just like so painful. Is it hard for you to do the show? And I mean, you're married. You've been married for, I forget how long, 11 years maybe?
Going on 10, but yeah.
So is it hard for you to play the role of somebody who's just lost their wife? Is that too painful to think about sometimes?
It is, and that's kind of another thing that we kind of moved away from the pilot originally, the original pilot. Like we started at, you know, almost the reception of the funeral. So like the pain was so recent that it kind of didn't allow for a comedic setting to really take hold, basically, and the show just played very melancholy. So we kind of moved it away from, like, you know, maybe a year or so, and it's not so fresh and so recent that he can talk finally without falling apart and stuff like that, but still spiraling out of control because he's juggling so much emotion with responsibility and running a show and all kinds of things. So, you know, just being overly vulnerable, but also being a dumb man and not really one to admit when he's wrong when he needs to.
Is it sometimes weird to be playing a father on TV who's not able to be home with his kid as much as he wants because he's so busy? And you're playing this father, which is keeping you from being home with your kids because doing that show, playing the father, is keeping you so busy.
Yeah, it's a bit of a whirlwind, you know? Like, I wake up and make breakfast for my kids, and then I go do a scene where I'm making some sort of meal for my TV children, too, you know? Like, I'm living my character kind of 24/7 in a weird way. But it keeps me focused on the fact that I am, you know, a parent and how attentive I really do want to be with my children and my wife and, you know, my family as well. Like, my brother, sister, my parents are still with me, thank God. Like, you know, I just want to make sure that I'm available to whoever. So, I don't know. I'm just like that. I would rather not sit in solitude necessarily unless I'm taking a nap.
You grew up in Atlanta. You had your first paid gig when you were 10 in a TV commercial for Lee's Famous Recipe Chicken. Was that a local chicken place?
Yeah, it was local in the South, but there wasn't one in Georgia, so I never got to see the commercial. It was in, like, all the surrounding states, like Tennessee and, like, the Carolinas and, you know, Alabama and stuff like that. So that bummed me out. I wish I could see the commercial now. I tried looking for it, but couldn't find it.
What did you have to do in it?
I was fishing with my fake grandfather, and that was freaking me out a little bit because that was my first time, like, working with another actor, I guess, like, on a paid kind of thing. I don't know. It was just weird seeing, like, some dude just, like, getting into character, and we're supposed to be acting like we're family or whatever. Like, what I'd done up until that point was all much more, like, random things, like Mr. White Cat and Hansel and Gretel and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So it was weird to try to, like, play family with a stranger, especially as a little kid. So stranger danger was a big part of life back then. But we're supposed to be fishing, and I say, like, the fish aren't biting, and he hands me a piece of chicken, and I'm supposed to take a bite of the chicken and say, I like this kind of biting. You know, classic da-dum-dum type comedy, basically. So I got to eat chicken all day, and I was happy.
Did you think to yourself, when you were 10 and you were doing this part, this isn't very funny, but I'll do it anyways?
Well, I remember the director kept telling me to take a bigger bite of chicken, like, take a big bite of chicken, big old bite, bigger, bigger bite of chicken. And I was like, this is starting to lean a little racist, but, you know, my fake granddad seems to be all right with it.
Let me reintroduce you here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kenan Thompson, and he's nominated for 2 Emmys, one for his performances on Saturday Night Live, and the other for his new sitcom, Kenan, which is on NBC and is now streaming free on NBC Peacock. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting the podcast Eleanor Amplified, an adventure series kids love. Hear reporter Eleanor outwit crafty villains and solve mysteries as she travels the globe to get the big story. Available where you get podcasts or at WHYY.org.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Kenan Thompson. He's nominated for 2 Emmys, for his comedy performances on SNL and for his starring role in his sitcom Kenan, which premiered this year. So you did a couple of things for Nickelodeon, and then you did the live-action adaptation of the animated series Fat Albert, based on characters originated by Bill Cosby, and he voiced Fat Albert in the original animated series. What did you like about the character? And, like, describe the character for anyone who's not familiar with him.
Fat Albert's just a big, jolly leader of the gang, you know, and he's all about, this is the guy the lessons come through. So whatever the lesson is, the episode is about, you know, Fat Albert would be the leader of, you know, helping to discover and bring to light for those characters that need to learn something, whatever it is they need to learn, mixed with music, you know. And Cosby was just like one of those go-to, like, feel-good American dad kind of destinations when I was growing up. So to get a chance to play the, you know, iconic character, you know, Fat Albert's a big character in the culture. I think FUBU had just finished doing their line of, like, Fat Albert character clothing and stuff like that, and it did really well because it was such a retro kind of thing that everybody loved from their childhood and stuff like that. So it just felt like, you know, an opportunity to do something big for the culture.
So how old were you when you started doing it?
When I did Fat Albert?
Uh-huh.
I was 25, 6.
So you had a catchphrase, hey, hey, hey.
Uh-huh.
What's it like to have a catchphrase? Do people come up with you and repeat it to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we were promoting that movie, definitely people would run up, you know, when they saw it. I mean, it was a big promotion. Like, the whole poster was just my face and, you know, me in that sweater, and you could kind of see that I'm a larger kind of person. So, like, seeing big, giant, like, billboards, and, like, they had a huge banner down the side of Madison Square Garden, like, it was a lot, you know, like they put me on blast, and I was like, wow, this is a big, big, big thing. And it was, you know, very flattering. It was very cool. But, you know, it definitely was, you know, for someone who kind of enjoys their privacy, not necessarily like the most private moment. Like, my face was everywhere.
Are you very private?
I mean, I'm protective, I guess. So I never want, like, my celebrity to, you know, bleed on other people's, you know, security or, you know, how their day is going. Like, if somebody wants to, like, say something negative to, you know, my family members based on just trying to be funny because they want to comment on something that I've done or anything like that, like, I always hate that.
Were you close with Bill Cosby when you were doing Fat Albert?
Not necessarily close, but, you know, he was a very busy man. So when he was around, he was very engaging and open and stuff like that. But he was only around like 3 times. So I didn't get to spend much time with him. But promoting the movie, he was, you know, he brought me to the Apollo to open for him once. That was my first time, like, being at the Apollo and stuff like that. And in Philly, we were doing, like, interviews and stuff like that together where we had the premiere for the movie. So he was available when he was available, but no, I didn't spend much time with him.
What did you do when you opened for him?
I made a fool out of myself, basically, like, tell people where the exit doors were instead of doing jokes. Like, I didn't have any jokes. I'm not a stand-up. So I just felt like a real fish out of water, but basically just getting everybody psyched to see Bill Cosby. And then he would go out and perform for 3 hours wearing a sweater with my face on it, like a Fat Albert sweater. It was crazy.
How did you feel when you found out about the roofies and how he sexually assaulted women? What was that like for you?
I mean, I'm sure nothing in comparison to, like, the people that were really affected by it, but it definitely didn't feel good to be close to any kind of behavior like that. So I wanted, you know, whatever justice that could be served. But yeah, the whole thing just felt gross. You know what I mean? It felt gross to be in such a close proximity to that. But I was proud of the work that me and my castmates did on that movie because we spent a lot of time together and we had a great time. You know, it was a lot of work, but we got through it together, like through laughter and just us being close and young and good people. So I was still proud of the movie, but definitely kind of devastated that it had this, you know, shadow around it now.
You were not the person who was assaulted, but did you still feel betrayed by him? You know, you had looked up to him.
Oh, absolutely. I felt the exact betrayal.
You know, he was just a father figure for so many people.
1,000%. I felt like a heavy betrayal, basically, because, you know, he was, you know, the guy when I was growing up. He was like the one clean comic. So, you know, I watched Bill Cosby himself thousands of times. Like, he was basically my introduction to what comedy was and what sitcoms were and all that kind of thing. And then, like, learning his history and his career. And, you know, he was like the first probably autobiography that I read and stuff like that. So yeah, he was a prime example of a career that I wanted to have. And, you know, the kind of guy I thought I wanted to be as far as like being a father and being a comedian is concerned and stuff like that. And then you hear rumors about, you know, when Eddie Murphy came out and said that he wasn't, you know, treating Eddie Murphy right. And, you know, Eddie was like, well, I want to be my own person. Like, you know, whatever. You let that wash off your back. And then you hear rumors of this and that and the other as time goes by. And it's like, all right, well, I guess he's got weird stuff going on or whatever. Like, but, you know, it's in the court's hands. I guess they're capable people. Like, whatever is happening, it's happening. And they'll find out exactly, you know, how to go about it. Let me mind my business type of thing. But then it gets to the point where real allegations and real numbers like start coming out, and that's when it's like unavoidable, and the outcome is, you know, the present outcome and the present reality that we live in, and it just sucks, man. It really sucks. I felt super betrayed for being such a big fan and, you know, idolizing somebody who was, you know, entrenched in what they were entrenched in.
So you got to play Bill Cosby in a very funny sketch in which Cosby is in prison. So the premise is you're alone in your cell when the prison guard brings in a new prisoner who is going to be your new cellmate. And the new prisoner is played by Seth Meyers. So let's hear a clip from this sketch, and Seth Meyers as the new prisoner speaks first.
So what are you in here for?
You don't ask a man that in here. You put your head down. Keep to your business.
Wow, old timer, you really know the ropes. I've never done time before. This friggin' sucks.
Hey! You don't come in here with your filth and your foul, foul filth. You need to get a job.
Hey, Cosby, keep it down. This is the 10th warning in... You've only been here 4 days. Lights on!
Wow. Bill Cosby, I mean, on behalf of every one of your fans, it is so disappointing to be meeting you now.
What? I am in my prime. I'm in jail and loving it. No kids with the darndest things. Limited interactions with Camille. And when I was fighting incarceration, I had no idea that one of the staple foods of the prison system is Jell-O.
So that's a sketch from Saturday Night Live from 2018 with my guest Kenan Thompson as Bill Cosby and Seth Meyers as his new cellmate. How did you feel about playing Cosby in prison?
It was just so crazy, you know, like it was kind of like playing OJ. I don't take pleasure from it, but, you know, our job is to kind of reflect our realities, basically. And the reality is Bill Cosby was in jail, or there's a guy named OJ back walking the streets and going to dinner with people, you know. So it was one of those things, like, you know, it's kind of part of our job as opposed to like, oh, this is something I'm excited about doing.
Well, Kenan Thompson, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
An absolute pleasure. I can't believe you listened to all of that.
Kenan Thompson is nominated for 2 Emmys for his comedic performances on SNL and for his starring role in the NBC sitcom Kenan. After a break, Maureen Carrigan will review a new novel about a nun who can no longer be deferential to reckless priests. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Hotwire. Imagine a nice vacation. Is there a view of the parking lot? No. So don't book a cheap hotel. Book an expensive hotel for cheap on Hotwire. You can stay in a nicer hotel than you ever thought possible. Just select your city, neighborhood, and amenities, then get your hot rate. Better views, king-size beds, and freshly pressed waffle-woven robes await you. And also actual waffles. Download the Hotwire app now and book beyond your wildest means. All bookings final.
When's the last time you read a moving and deadpan funny novel about religious life, faith, and doubt? Our book critic Maureen Carrigan says she has one to recommend. It's called Agatha of Little Neon, and it's by first-time novelist Claire Luchetti.
I was a Catholic schoolgirl during a strange moment in the 1960s when Catholicism infiltrated American popular culture. For a brief time, nuns in particular were everywhere. The Flying Nun, starring a buoyant Sally Field, was on TV. The Singing Nun appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, and her life was made into a movie. There was The Trouble with Angels and the Mother Superior of all nun movies, The Sound of Music. Nuns, of course, have greatly diminished in number since the 60s, and in recent decades, when they do make an occasional appearance on screen, they're often grim, even Baroque characters, like Meryl Streep's Sister Aloysius in Doubt, or Jessica Lange's Sister Jude in American Horror Story. The implication is that there must be something off about a woman who would choose such a life of self-abnegation. Claire Lucetti's debut novel, Agatha of Little Neon, offers a counter-narrative about a young 21st century nun who's neither a holy fool, nor a musical miracle worker, nor a monster. I picked up Agatha of Little Neon for its unusual subject, and I got pulled in by Agatha's voice. Sharp and by turns melancholy and wry, Agatha narrates her own belated coming-of-age tale about, as she says, learning how to distinguish an idea of yourself from the real thing. Agatha tells her story in retrospect, beginning in 2005 in her convent outside of Buffalo, New York. It's a place with walls painted the color of mayonnaise, ruled by a beloved elderly Mother Superior, frail as filament. Agatha has spent 7 years there, ever since she took her vows at the age of 22. She and three fellow sisters, all the same age, run a daycare center. But when the novel opens, the diocese is going broke because, as Agatha tactfully says, the men in charge had been reckless. Later on, when Agatha is all out of deference, she's more lacerating about the recklessness, sexual as well as monetary, of those priests who are in charge. Abruptly booted out of their convent, the four sisters are transferred to a halfway house in the depressed Rhode Island town of Woonsocket. There, without any training, they're expected to minister to recovering addicts and ex-convicts. Here's Agatha's first impression of her new posting. Woonsocket, a tuckered-out town in northern Rhode Island, split down the middle by a river of waste. The sidewalks were littered with condoms and crushed empties. From Woonsocket, you could vomit into Massachusetts. From Massachusetts, kids came to buy liquor and fentanyl after 9. The halfway house is the color of Mountain Dew, a yellow-green discount paint that makes the house visible from 3 blocks away. Hence the name Little Neon. Agatha observes that usually when people saw our habits, they ceased to see our faces. And most of the halfway house residents behaved that way, barely interacting with the sisters. But one recovering addict named Tim Gary is different. Tim, who's lost half his jawbone to cancer and got hooked on Dilaudid, recognizes a fellow lost soul in Agatha, and Agatha is further pulled away from her community when she's ordered to teach geometry at a nearby girls' Catholic high school, an ordeal that should qualify her for sainthood. What's especially striking about Lucetti's novel is that it affirms the age-old writing workshop wisdom of show, don't tell. Despite the fact that our narrator lives a contemplative life, she doesn't devote a lot of space to ruminations. Instead, every short chapter here is structured as a precise vignette, dramatizing different incidents in her and her fellow sisters' lives, from the mundane to the harrowing. For instance, there's the poverty of regular mealtimes at Little Neon, where cut-rate concoctions like chopped walnut tacos make appearances, and a scene where Agatha describes how her mother hemorrhaged to death after giving birth to a baby brother, and how, for a grieving Agatha, church was the only thing in her life that pulled her forward. Until it doesn't. You could learn to live without a part of yourself, Agatha tells us. I did. For years, I lived like this. And then I started to yearn for what I had lost. You don't have to be Catholic to connect with Luchetti's nuanced and vivid story of a lonely young woman yearning for community and also yearning for everything she's had to give up to be part of that community. The nuns don't fly or sing or torment the helpless in Agatha of Little Neon, but they do make an indelible impression.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Agatha of Little Neon by Claire Luchetti. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about the latest revelations about what Trump tried to do to subvert the results of the election. My guest will be Katie Benner, who covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. We'll also talk about the DOJ under Merrick Garland. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Amory Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.